Welcome to Morgan Lewis Podcast Central. This is a podcast recording from Morgan Lewis's April 21st, 2015 8th Annual Conference, Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices. Morgan Lewis partners Jed Wider and Timothy Levin shared this 14-part in-depth discussion of U.S. and international advanced hedge fund topics focusing on manager and investor perspectives. Part 11, Non-Transparent Actively Managed ETFs and Smart Beta. John McGuire, Rich Morris, and Bill Zimmerman will discuss non-transparent actively managed ETFs and smart beta. Now, on to the podcast.
My name is Richard Morris. I'm a partner here in the New York office. With me on my left is John McGuire, a partner in our funds practice group from Washington, D.C., and Bill Zimmerman, a tax partner in our Philadelphia office. Today, we're here to talk to you about exchange-traded funds, or ETFs. You might be asking yourselves, why are we talking about ETFs at a hedge fund conference? That's a good question, and we hope at the end of this 20 minutes that we'll have given you the answers to those questions, and we'll given you a few things for you and your firms to think about with respect to ETFs and exchange-traded products in general. On the slides, we have an overview of what we're going to talk about. The first is a little bit about the question of why you should care about ETFs as a hedge fund. We'll talk a little bit about what they are, a little bit about the regulatory background, and we'll talk at the end about some next steps in the development of ETFs and exchange-traded products. So first, the question of why you should care. ETFs have been increasingly popular with investors over the last decade. They're approaching almost $2 trillion in assets under management from about $225 billion 10 years ago. And this includes both retail investors and institutional investors. There are many hedge funds that are using ETFs to gain exposure to a variety of strategies. We see some of that in this next slide. The primary purpose of this next slide is to just show you that the type of assets that ETFs have been investing in have been diversifying. That continues a little bit on the following slide, which talks about ETFs tracking strategies beyond cap-weighted indexes. As we'll talk about a little bit more, ETFs have historically been index tracking vehicles, traditionally investing in cap-weighted indices. We've seen that change starting in 2006 with the development of some alternative-based indices as the underlying vehicles for ETFs. In 2008, we saw actively managed ETFs launch for the first time. And what we're seeing lately is a trend, consistent with the trend in the investment management industry in general, towards ETFs investing in alternative asset classes. We are seeing more hedge fund managers thinking about managing ETFs, and we're seeing more ETF sponsors thinking about how they can use hedge fund strategies in their ETF vehicles. Most ETFs are registered under the 1940 Act. That's the Investment Company Act of 1940, but not all are. So at this point, I'm going to turn it over to my two co-panelists to talk a little bit about the different types of what we call ETPs, exchange-traded products, or ETFs that are currently in the marketplace. John?
Sure. The one thing that all ETPs have in common is they're registered under the Securities Act of 1933, and you have the differentiation between those that are also registered under the 40 Act as investment companies and those that are not. Those that are not can fit in different categories. One is an exchange-traded note, which is simply a debt instrument that will track a particular index that is typically an index that is not one that's easily investable. So you would have someone issuing this note that's going to track the performance of a particular index rather than do it as you would normally do it with an ETF, which would actually invest in the underlying securities. So that's one option. Another option is just a 33 Act product that would hold something other than securities, could hold commodities, could hold metals, could hold currency, and those have different tax structures, but they're all essentially a 33 Act registered product. That allows you to do the interesting things like gold and silver and euros and yen.
Sure, and as John indicated, the differences between these products are somewhat based in the tax differences. Most registered ETFs under the 40 Act, those ETFs are gonna be taxed as mutual funds. They're going to be called regulated investment companies under the code. Those exchange-traded products which invest in physical commodities where there is no power to vary on the part of the sponsor or the trustee, those type of exchange-traded products are going to be treated what we call grantor trusts under the tax rules. There really is no entity. Each owner owns an undivided portion of the underlying. And then you get into areas where if there is a power to vary the returns on the investment, that is, if an advisor has the power to make business decisions to take advantage of changes in the marketplace, in that intermediate ground, you're going to have a publicly traded partnership. And each one of those has their own restrictions, and most of them are all going to have what we call flow-through type treatment. If you meet those restrictions, you're not going to have an entity-level tax. But those are the main differences between those type of exchange-traded products. And oftentimes, people are not clear in how they refer to these different entities, so we get questions about, I want a mutual fund that's going to invest in all exchange-traded funds. And we provide disclosure that says, you know, you're going to invest in two 40 Act ETFs. And they said, no, I meant exchange-traded products. And so they meant a broader array of these type of products. But there are tax differences which also lead into the differences that John was referring to.
And Bill, some of these have advantages for the investors, right? Because some of them get one type of, you know, the 1099, and others are treated more like a partnership, as you indicated. So that's the advantage.
And quite often, that's exactly what we deal with, is clients come to us and say, you know, the marketplace doesn't want a K-1. We have to have a product that is going to issue a 1099. And those type of products are going to be your mutual fund or 40 Act-based ETFs, as well as your commodity-based gold ETFs are going to give you a 1099. Those publicly traded partnerships, obviously their partnerships are going to give you a Form K-1, which the marketplace has a reluctance to receive.
So I think what we wanted you to take away from this introductory part of the presentation was that there's a general label that's often used called ETFs. Probably the more precise term is exchange-traded products, which can include a subset of products registered under the 1940 Act, the 1933 Act, or that are simply exchange-traded notes. We're going to spend the rest of our time talking mostly about products that are registered under the 1940 Act. We get a lot of questions from hedge fund managers about managing investment companies using hedge fund strategies. We're starting to see some questions around hedge fund managers wanting to manage ETFs and the sponsors asking the same questions. We had an earlier panel on the specific portfolio issues that you should worry about, but now we're just going to talk a little bit about the ETF framework. So John, we hear people talk about the ETF exemptive application process and what that means. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. An ETF doesn't fit nicely in the structure of the 40 Act. The 40 Act was designed for open-end funds and closed-end funds. Closed-end funds trading on an exchange, open-end funds not trading on an exchange, but rather issuing and redeeming shares on a daily basis. An ETF is somewhere in the middle. An ETF will issue and redeem shares on a daily basis in large aggregations to APs, and the shares will trade individually on the exchange. But because it doesn't fit within the 40 Act, you have to have exemptive relief from the Securities and Exchange Commission in order to operate an ETF. Now, the good news is this is something that has been going on for slightly over 20 years now with the development of the SPDR, and it has evolved over that time. Now we file exemptive applications routinely to get exemptive relief to allow ETFs to operate, all manner of ETFs. Initially, as Rich indicated, they were index tracking products, but now we have actively managed ETFs in both contexts, active and passive. We're investing in foreign securities, fixed income securities, equity securities. So it's really the whole gamut of securities are covered by the types of exemptive applications we file. This is a process that requires filing a rather large application with the SEC. The SEC reviews that. They give you any comments they might have, and then it's published or put on notice, and then they will issue the order shortly after that. Process over the years has varied as to how long it takes. At one point, It was easily a year to get these types of applications.
Or more.
And certainly if you were doing a novel product, it could take years and years. Now, if you're trying to seek a more typical type relief that other people have already gotten, it's less than a year, and I don't want to make any promises to a room full of people on how short that would be.
So John, in approving those exemptive applications, the SEC is very much concerned about ETF trading and transparency. Can you talk about that for a minute?
Well, one of the things that the SEC and the industry, in fact, has told them over the years is the key to an ETF really working is by having what's called an arbitrage mechanism. And that is that these large broker dealers that can go in and out of an ETF on a daily basis and do these large creations and redemptions with the ETF will discipline the market price of the ETF. Because if there was ever a divergence between the market price and the actual net asset value of the ETF, one of these large broker dealers would move into the market and close the price, and you would end up with the market price being very close to the net asset value. One of the things that has been said for years is that one of the essential elements of that is to allow those large broker dealers to see what is actually in the portfolio, hence the transparency that you hear talked about all the time. There was actually recently some news about some ETFs not being fully transparent. And index ETFs have never been required to be fully transparent because they track an index. But on the actively managed side, you actually put the whole portfolio on your website every day.
Right, right. So transparency is a key to trading. And one of the things that helps the authorized participants that trade the ETFs do is decide when to do creation and redemption baskets. And I did want to ask Bill one question before that I forgot. Why is it that ETFs tend to be more tax efficient than traditional mutual funds?
ETFs are tax efficient, and it plays off of exactly what John was just describing, which is that transaction where these authorized participants come in with shares of the ETF and request redemption of those shares in exchange for the physical in-kind basket of securities, which are going to be exchanged for those shares. And it just so happens there's a special provision in the tax code with respect to mutual funds. It's not in, everybody thinks it's out there for ETFs to make them tax efficient, but in reality, it's been in the code since the 1940s. It was designed to prevent a spiraling market from having an ETF go out and sell their shares in order to reduce it to cash to satisfy huge redemption requests. But what it says is that an ETF, a mutual fund, is able to satisfy redemption requests from shareholders by distributing out in kind and not have an entity level tax. So what this does is that it allows these ETFs not to push out capital gain distributions as traditional mutual funds would do, and hence it becomes very tax efficient. That doesn't mean that the taxes aren't paid. There's still gain, which is inherent in the shareholders, difference between the NAV of the fund and the shareholders' tax basis. It's just that if you are a longtime holder, that you can defer those gains and that recognition until the time you dispose of it, whereas compared to a regular traditional mutual fund, you might receive capital gain distributions.
So a couple of the benefits of ETFs then are intraday trading and tax efficiency, potential tax efficiency. One of the things that we've not seen, though, is a large-scale adoption of ETFs by active managers. What we are seeing, though, and have seen over the last couple of years, is exemptive applications filed with the SEC to permit less than fully transparent ETFs or to permit new types of product structures known as exchange-traded managed funds. John, can you talk a little bit about the less than fully transparent ETPs and in particular the blind trust model?
Sure. The reason why active management hasn't moved to the ETF structure is because of the transparency. And if you're a stock picker, you don't want to tell the world what stocks you're picking. You want to keep that to yourself and manage your portfolio and disclose it after the fact like a mutual fund does. With an ETF, because of the transparency requirement, the application that was filed seeking, and there were actually multiple applications that were filed using this structure, they wanted to interpose what has been termed a blind trust between the authorized participant, which is the large broker dealer who would be doing the creations and redeems with the ETF, between the ETF and the broker dealer. So this blind trust would be an entity, typically a bank. Bank would serve as trustee of the trust. And the creations, if you were doing a create, if you were a large broker creating in this ETF, you would put in an order to your blind trust saying, we want to purchase creation unit of XYZ ETF. They would get the information as to what was the creation basket of securities that they needed to put into the ETF. They would do that transaction, the blind trust would get the shares of the ETF back, and those would be funneled directly to the broker-dealer. So it's essentially putting this filter in between the broker-dealer and the fund, primarily for the purpose of keeping the information about what is in the fund away from the broker-dealer so they wouldn't be able to trade on it.
So they're basically trying to use the blind trust as a proxy for the transparency that we referred to.
Absolutely.
And unfortunately, it seems like that's at least currently stalled at the SEC.
It has stalled at the SEC. They had a very public denial of a proposal last fall where they were seeking to rely on something called an intraday indicative value that ETFs currently publish that's out there every 15 seconds. And the SEC, by the way, requires. But the SEC, in their denial, said that, well, it's really not a valuable piece of information, and the market really couldn't use that to make a market, and we have no assurance that we would be able to have this arbitrage mechanism that I described before actually work. So it has seemed to stall, but it's actually been a very popular idea in the industry. So there's a lot of people who are still trying to make that structure work. But there are other structures.
There's other structures. I think it's popular because a lot of people like you, hedge fund managers, want to use this in the ETF space. There's structures that have proposed publishing proxy data about the portfolio that are working their way through the SEC. But there's also a very interesting product structure that has been approved called the Exchange-Traded Managed Fund, or ETMF. That's an open-end investment company. It's registered under the 1940 Act. It works much the same way as a traditional ETF, but it does not have the daily portfolio transparency. It publishes its holdings on a quarterly basis. And instead of relying on that intraday transparency for effective arbitrage, it basically sets the intraday price at the NAV, the end-of-day NAV of the ETF, plus or minus a premium. So it was that unique feature, this idea that it would be trading at a set NAV amount or premium or discount to the fund's end-of-day net asset value rather than a dollar amount that could fluctuate from the fund's net asset value intraday that helped the SEC get over the hump and approve that product. We haven't seen those product launch yet, but we do expect that we might see some ETMFs in 2015. Bill, we haven't really asked you any questions for a while, but do you see any significant tax issues for these non-transparent structures?
Well, I think they operate from a tax perspective the same way as the other ETFs, except for one notation, which is that the creation baskets may not be pro rata based across a slice of the portfolio. Now, the IRS has recognized that this particular code provision I referenced earlier is effective for regular ETFs, but has only issued private letter rulings in the context where you have redeemed a complete slice of your portfolio. But that doesn't mean that people aren't taking the position out there that you can take a non-pro rata slice of your portfolio or cherry pick low basis securities to distribute out to the redeeming APs in those transactions to make it very tax efficient. But it is something out there that you won't get a IRS private letter ruling on because they've sort of drawn a line in the sand that they'll only rule on complete pro rata redemptions.
Thank you, Bill. We're out of our time, so thank you very much. We hope we've given you a little bit of an understanding of ETFs. Happy to answer any questions offline.
To listen to other panels from the 2015 8th Annual Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices Conference, visit our Hedge Fund University at morganlewis.com/hedgefunduniversity. If you have any questions or would like more information on the topics addressed in this podcast, please contact a Morgan Lewis attorney at morganlewis.com. This podcast is provided as a general informational service to clients and friends of Morgan Lewis & Bockius, LLP. It should not be construed as and does not constitute legal advice on any specific matter, nor does this message create an attorney-client relationship. These materials may be considered attorney advertising in some states. Please note that any prior results discussed in the material do not guarantee similar outcomes. Read more about Morgan Lewis and its hedge funds practice at morganlewis.com/hedgefunduniversity.